Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And it's a very viney, intertwined, yummy, beautiful show.
All of the above.
All of the above.
And below.
We're going to talk with Paula Raffi.
That's her. She is an author and writer and lecturer in Atlanta, Georgia. And she's very good. She knows her stuff. And she's going to talk about vines, which people inherently like in their garden, but never quite sure what to do with them, how to do with them, how to deal with them. And they can be pretty tricky. I love them, too. We have a bunch of them. But you have to use them in the right place in the right way, or they just run around and take over things, and people are very unhappy. So it's an art form. Vines can be, and she's going to explain the entire thing.
She's got some good information on designing with vines. You know, anything from the fast annual tropical vine to the more stately...
the lumbering climbing hydrangea.
Exactly.
Is what it is. So,
which is it is
big
what it is.
Big lumbering climbing hydrangea.
It takes a little more patience and maintenance, I think, than an annual vine. But worth it indeed. Yes. And we're going to talk to Jerry Gettle. He started Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds back in the late 90s. A young guy, just interested in the pioneer history of the Missouri area, heirloom seeds, culture, you know, worldwide sort of association with some of these heirloom seeds. It's a really neat place with a hardcore, I think, goal of preserving the past, don't you think?
Yeah, it's taken off, and he gets seeds from all over the world. It's kind of funny. He mentions that he'll get seed packets every week from somewhere, Romania, might be Guatemala. Somebody is sending grandma's favorite squash, and here it is in Mansfield, Missouri.
And a good story behind it, too.
Absolutely.
But he's going to you know, tell us a little bit about what he's doing up there in Mansfield, Missouri, but also highlight some of the interesting heirloom squash that we can grow in our garden and why he thinks, and I have to agree, that they are superior in taste, to be sure, if you want to cook them up in the kitchen.
You would know better than I, Mrs.
I know. Well, I give you squash in the
and you eat them.
I would suspect that if you'll have to do a side by side with store bought squash and my squash like you did with the eggs.
Well, yeah, we're having eggs and squash every day now.
We will be too. But that's coming up today on Homegrown. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Well, two rather different things, I guess. One is I've got my third tricolored beech, which is one of my favorite trees. I love the thing. It's kind of pink and purple and kind of cream. The leaves are all at once. It's just a gorgeous plant, and I've got a backlit. I've got that goofy pink bathtub out there, and I put it next to the pink bathtub, and it's kind of backlit. All this to encourage people, if you haven't tried a tricolored beech and you have some room in a special place, they're really fun to have. And I'm just declaring this the best spring in the history of the world.
I think so, too.
This is it. The rain has been perfect so far. The weather's been perfect. It's kind of English and Vancouver-like. Kind of cool and just enough water to keep things going. We rarely water anything anymore.
Yeah,
we haven't for a while.
Which is nice.
It's just been fabulous.
You are absolutely right.
And I'm declaring it the best ever.
The only downside is that, you know, a subtle emergence for us of the cicadas at the farm.
Oh,
but I can deal with that because it's not going to be bad, I don't think. So
I'm just excited about spring. And,
I am too.
This is the best one ever. How about the Wishy Estate?
It fills me up. It makes me happy, to be sure.
Oh, yeah.
Just noticing, and, you know, just a word on, to encourage patience. Some trees that we planted last year and the last couple of years, and you know, probably because the hard freeze last year and then the drought, we lost some things right after bud swell. So it's like the trees swelled and then that was all they had.
I lost a sourwood.
And they died. Yeah. And it's interesting how they do that. And you can look and you can see, you know, that maybe the vascular system's been disrupted because of some sort of scarring or cracking or something on the trunk or, you know, who knows what. But a word of patience. Often, if you do see that kind of messed up trunk where basically like blood can't get to the above part, it doesn't mean that your root system is not still viable. And Bob, this little oak, teeny little oak that Andy had planted, dead, but now like there's an oak shrub coming up. So we're going to watch and see who looks the strongest. We're going to prune everybody else away. And we'll likely have an oak tree catch up same size as what was there already because we still have a good strong root system, but a little critter girdled the tree because it chewed at the base of the tree.
Those darn little critters.
Yeah, like a little field mice or something.
Wasn't a chicken, was it?
It wasn't a chicken. It's way, way, way far away from the chicken.
Okay.
And it happened in the wintertime. But just a word of patience because sometimes stuff will come back from the root system. And honestly, if it's a really strong root system, that little twig will catch up with whatever little twig was there before and died.
I waited my sourwood out because I've lost two out of three now.
Sourwoods are hard.
They're real hard.
They're very picky.
I've got one that's doing well. The other two are mm-hmm. at Ratterman.
Ours always, for all the years that I can remember, has always looked like it's at death's door. It's still alive, though.
Yeah, I know. It was one of your dad's favorites.
It's still alive. Yeah. All right. There's some stuff going on around town this weekend for sure. On June 14th, I'm going to be out at the St. Matthew's Farm Market, which is a new farm market, second year this year at Beargrass Christian Church there on Shelbyville Road. A nice farm market. So come out and see me and check out what they've got. If you don't grow your own squash, you can buy them from somebody else who is. And then there's also a miniature rose show put on by the Louisville Rose Society June 14th. It's going to be out at the Lowe's store at Norton Healthcare Boulevard. And this is predominantly a show with mini roses. Their big show is going to come up in September. But the public is invited to come from 1:30 to 5 p.m. to take a look at the miniature rose plants and arrangements there.
Yeah, this is a national event with local implications. The Garden Conservancy, I think that we've had them on the show from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
One weekend a year, so they show gardens across the nation, and there's five local gardens on June 14th. That's also Saturday. There'll be five gardens in the Louisville area. You can get a special pass, five gardens for $20. For more information, contact UDEL, which is one of the gardens on the tour, or just go to our website for five of the best gardens in Louisville for the Garden Conservancy's open days.
Open days.
And speaking of open days, we're going to talk openly with a woman named Paula Rafe. She's a self-employed designer of residential landscapes, lectures regularly at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, and is past president of the Georgia Perennial Plant Association. She most recently had an article entitled Designing with Vines in the American Gardener. She's with us today to talk just about that. Paula, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks, Bob.
You have a great bio. It said you had a master's degree in biology from Georgetown, and now you're off landscaping gardens. Can you kind of take us down that path a little bit?
Oh, it's just an evolution. I actually wanted to study horticulture when I was in grad school, but the National Science Foundation wasn't interested in that. I went with what they gave me money to do, and then as my family came and my interest shifted course, I was able to kind of build on the horticulture thing.
Sure. The two relate, sort of, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. I call on that old knowledge all the time, my Latin comes back.
Yeah.
That's good.
Excellent.
Yeah, and vines is a great subject because so many people talk about them and intuitively like them, but really aren't sure how to deal with them. So let's kind of begin by a homeowner comes to you and says, I love vines. I want to put some in my yard. What are the first basic steps in getting people in the right direction?
Well, I usually reply to that question with a lot of other questions. I toss the questions back at them, and I want to know, well, are you interested in an evergreen vine, or do you need a deciduous vine? Okay. Are you interested in an annual vine or a perennial? Do you have sun or shade? It's a thoughtful decision. It should be a thoughtful decision, not just an impulse based on the prettiest flower that you see,
mm-hmm.
because vines have a function in the garden besides just beauty, and it makes people start thinking about, well, what do I want it to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Well, and to that point, what do you want it to do? What do you want it to cover or block or,
mm-hmm.
or you know, provide a backdrop for, right? A couple
That's
of the different
absolutely. Vines
issues.
Cover a multitude of illnesses or however you want to say it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe you've heard that quote from Frank Lloyd Wright. It goes something like, the physician can bury his mistakes, but an architect can only advise his clients to plant vines. And how many chain link fences would be improved by, mm-hmm. you know, just a few scarlet runner beans?
Exactly.
You know, even gourds. Mm-hmm. I mean, so they really do hide things, mm-hmm. and they soften hard structures and give you absolutely, Janine, you mentioned as a backdrop for something else. I have, in my own backyard, and I don't take credit for it, one of my ancestors covered up an old hog wire fence with English ivy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back in the 30s, that was an easy way to hide a utilitarian fence. And in front of that, I can display hydrangeas and all other kind of things. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they have a job to do.
Yeah. So let's talk about kind of material, because I think, too, we have to kind of match the right kind of vine with the right kind of like construction material,
mm-hmm.
if you will. What's your house made of?
Mm-hmm.
Our house is a Western cedar, so I always felt like it was better to have a deciduous vine instead of English ivy because at least it could like air out in the wintertime. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I know people always ask, are there issues with their brick and their mortar? And I'm like, well, by the time there is, you'll be dead. So it doesn't matter. Enjoy it. Which I don't know if is really, if that's good advice or not. But different vines cling and are more suitable to different sorts of construction and what they're going to grow on. Can you talk about that as well?
Yes, very, very important, the combination of the vine with the surface. And Janine, you mentioned a wooden surface. And I'm very leery of people putting any kind of vine on a wooden house.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it, even if it doesn't penetrate the wood, it shades the wood and leaves it moist when you want it to dry out. And
right.
So that's a problem. On the other hand, if you have a brick surface or stucco, real stucco, and or a stone wall, they're really very good surfaces for vines. And the other thing is to create a structure to support a vine.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, what that structure is made of needs to be taken into account. I find people have a tendency to over-design an arbor that they're just going to cover up with a rampant vine, and then you don't even see the beautiful woodwork.
Right. Exactly.
Or if it's made of, if it's wood, and then they paint it a lovely white, well, forget about that. It's not going to be white for long. I tend toward the more utilitarian structures where the structure disappears, maybe tubular steel covered with black vinyl, and these are available in all kinds of sizes and shapes. And the vine covers it, and it's supported, and the vine is the visible feature there, and
mm-hmm.
the structure is not important except
for
behind
durability.
The scenes,
yeah.
as it were. So, yeah, the structure and the vine need to go together, unless, of course, and that holds true even if you're using a plant, a big woody plant to support your vine. You want to match the vine to the plant host, so to speak.
Yeah, I've found that people are almost naive about vines. They think they want to plant it, and it'll stay in one place and flower all summer, and it's just going to be terrific.
Oh, stay in one place. Forget it.
Yeah.
One time, I heard Dan Hinckley, he began a talk on vines, and I think this was at the Scott Arboretum years ago. He said the vine is the only plant that you can put in one place, and then it has the ability to migrate to the most favorable environment. And yeah, and it's true. It gets you thinking. You know, you put it at the bottom of a sturdy shrub, and the next thing you know, it's sprawling over to the driveway to get more light.
Yeah, exactly. Well, your article did an excellent job in American Gardener on breaking down the different vines, the evergreen, the deciduous, the annual, the tropical, the hardy, and, of course, the invasive, the dreaded invasive ones. Let's kind of take them one step at a time. You mentioned evergreens first. And actually, I grow Carolina jasmine here, and it's been hardy, and as has the bignonia, but that's two of the ones you mentioned as evergreens.
Yes, and both of those are natives. I love to use natives if I can, and especially if they're adaptable and easy to grow. The difference is they climb in different ways. So the Carolina jasmine is going to cling on its own and twine around a vertical structure, whereas the bignonia sends out these little rootlets that have to attach as it goes. And that might be an attachment to a tree trunk in the woods, which is what happens naturally, or it could attach to a masonry wall,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen several good applications of bignonia to soften a big two-story stone wall.
I bet that's
and
beautiful.
It just will climb it's all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
I've got one 40 foot up a hackberry tree, literally.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and I hope you get to see the flowers.
Oh, this right now, it's incredible. Thousands of orange flowers, and the hummingbirds seem to like
exactly.
them.
Exactly, that's another benefit of the bignonia. We call it crossvine, but it's very prevalent in the South.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the twining versus the sort of sticking to.
Mm-hmm.
Those, I think, would be important considerations for people to kind of keep in the back of their mind as well in terms of what they want to cover and how the actual vine will attach itself.
Mm-hmm. It's not that you plant the vine and let it find its own way. You have to be vigilant in the beginning just to get it headed in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these, I'll call them self-clingers, like the bignonia or crossvine or climbing hydrangea, it's important at the beginning that they feel the physical surface next to them, because that's what stimulates the production of these little tiny rootlets.
Oh,
wow.
And it's a special tropism. We call it thigmotropism, T-H-I-G-O-G-M-O, thigmotropism.
Oh.
And so in the beginning, if you're trying to train up a crossvine or a climbing hydrangea, you have to make that growing tip make contact with the surface. And it can be with a little piece of duct tape. It can be with just a stick that holds it against the surface until the plant decides that it will stick by itself. It doesn't take long during the growing season, but once it's there and it's attached, then it will continue all on its own.
So they're coachable.
Yeah, coachable. Educable. Wonderful.
Who says talking to your plants doesn't actually do something, right? That's amazing. All right, evergreen vines, cross vines, a good one, Carolina jasmine, katsura vine.
Oh, I like katsura vine, which is a Japanese evergreen, because it's a shade vine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those of us who have shade always feel like we have fewer choices. And I like katsura vine in its variegated form. It's a nice kind of tapered oval leaf, about 4 inches long. And there are two variegated forms. The one I like that I talked about in the article, Fukurin, has a creamy margin that's kind of irregular, and each leaf is a little bit different. So that variegation is great in the shade,
mm-hmm.
as
brightens
all variegation is.
Sure.
And it just, it's permanent all year. Just there, and you don't grow it for the flowers, you grow it for that pretty leaf,
mm-hmm.
glossy green with a little creamy edge.
Mm-hmm.
Then you mentioned deciduous vines, the Dutchman's pipe, which I really like, and
I do too.
The trumpet creeper. Tell us about those.
Well, Dutchman's pipe and trumpet creeper are both natives, rampant growers, and you always have to be aware of the mature size of any vine before you plant it. And the value of a deciduous vine, just like a deciduous tree, is it's good where you don't want it to be shady all year round. So just as, say, you plant a big old deciduous tree for the summer shade, and you want it to be open and sunny in the winter, the same with a deciduous vine. So this Dutchman's pipe was used to shade porches in the summertime in the south, and the same with the campsis or trumpet creeper. It'd be good if, say, you had a pergola or some kind of shade structure near your swimming pool or tennis court, and you just needed some relief from the sun during the hot months, grow a deciduous vine, whereas in the winter months you'd be happy to have the sun come through that space. So that goes back to the question of what do I want the vine to do for me?
Mm-hmm.
Then you mentioned the dreaded wisteria, which, why doesn't my wisteria bloom is the question I get more than how can I kill my moles. Can you talk about the wisteria issue and why some bloom and some don't?
First of all, if it's one of the Asian wisterias, it has to be of a certain age. Wisteria, I caution people about, even the hybrids, because it's so rampant.
Right.
But they require a lot of attention to pruning,
mm-hmm.
and fertilizing, but not too much. And I don't pretend to be an expert when it comes to wisteria, except that the American wisteria, Wisteria frutescens, is far easier to grow, far less threatening to a small garden. And though its flowers are not as huge and they're not quite as fragrant, it doesn't seem to be as problematic. If you choose a cultivar wisteria, the native wisteria called Amethyst Falls blooms from an early age.
Oh.
And so I get good reports about it,
mm-hmm.
and dependable bloom every year without all of this fretting about why my wisteria doesn't bloom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got a Kentucky wisteria, I think it's Macrostachys or something like that, blooming right now. It's the same way. It's about 20, 25 feet and just covered now and kind of blue purple.
And that must, I don't know, I've never seen that.
That's
here.
An American, must be an American cousin.
I'll have to look it up.
It's less invasive and does a really good job.
Yeah.
Good. Well, let's plant more of those natives.
Yeah.
My father used to call the climbing hydrangea the Cadillac of hydrangeas. He loved them, and you have this on your deciduous vine list as
now,
well.
Now, are you talking about the true hydrangea, or are you talking about schizophragma?
The true hydrangea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder why he said that. I think maybe because he associated it with England and ancient castles?
He just absolutely loved it.
And
I think it was like back in the day when you didn't see it on
right.
the market
well,
as much.
It was not common for years.
Right, because this would have been, he died 10 years ago, so it was, you know, previous to that, but he just was really trying to encourage people to get, you know, be patient and give it a chance.
Right. That's a vine that has a reputation for being slow to be established,
mm-hmm.
but Again, it's a very kind of woody vine. I don't know if you saw this on your dad's vine, Janine, but it sends out horizontal branches that project forward, and they collect leaf litter. And I have a client who actually ripped hers down because it was so untidy on the front of her house in the fall, and she didn't like the it gets very heavy, woody stems and laterals. The Asian form of that, which is not strictly speaking a hydrangea, the schizophragma, is much more refined. It clings to the wall better. The leaves are smaller, and it's not as unsightly in winter, but it doesn't bloom as well.
Mm-hmm.
But climbing hydrangea is a fun plant to have, and I think a plant for the connoisseur.
Yeah. It takes a little attention, too.
Yeah.
Because we did, let's see, the one that's there has been there for quite a long time, and it was some sort of weather episode that pulled half of it down.
Like
but actually, which was a good thing because it needed to be cut back, and then you've got all this new growth that's not as heavy, you know? So.
Well, you bring up an important point, Janine, because perennial vines and even the evergreen vines are not maintenance-free.
Mm-hmm.
They all, at some point, need to be cut back and rejuvenated. They will go on forever and ever, amen, unless you take the shears to them in a knowledgeable way every few years and keep them in control.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, another favorite vine you touched on is the Schizophragma Moonlight. It's the faster-growing, smaller flower, but it's got a beautiful gray-green leaf that I just love.
I think it's the leaf that is the reason you buy that plant.
Right.
Moonlight is a lovely sort of frosted foliage, and you get that frosting even in a shady situation. And I've never seen any schizophragma bloom its head off.
Right.
They never bloom their heads
even
off.
Even its feet.
they're shy.
Right.
So if you're going to plant one, I would plant the one with the pretty foliage, Moonlight.
Okay, let's go to the annuals and the tropicals. It's always a tough decision because I have had bad luck with them, frankly. They grow too fast. They don't flower enough for me. I can never seem to find that right annual vine that I want. So tell me what I'm doing wrong, Coach.
Annual vines are a piece of cake, really,
Okay.
Bob. I'm sorry.
Good.
And their value is when you want an inexpensive vine and a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are very rampant, and they're especially useful if you're gardening with children. Things like the purple hyacinth bean, which Thomas Jefferson grew, or even moonvine, are a mile a minute. I mean, they need is sun. Once you get them out of the ground.
And a little heat.
A little heat, the heat of summer and sun.
Uh-huh.
They will travel 20 feet in a season. Any of those annual vines are really, they're especially fun if you want to change your mind every summer and do something different.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you get a chance to pick up a different packet of seeds. And, you know, even at $2 a packet now, it's still cheaper than buying a potted plant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paula.
Oh, great.
Yeah, Paula, thank you. You've untangled a web of...
I hope so.
Or entangled.
Yeah.
No pun goes untangled here, believe me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was fun.
Paula Raffi is a landscape designer who lectures regularly at the Atlanta Botanical Garden and is past president of the Georgia Perennial Plant Association. For more information on Paula, the vines she mentioned, or how to take care of them, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Jared Gettle and the fabulous Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds in Mansfield, Missouri. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Ivy Rose, Ivy Rose, I'm in love with you. Cling to me, cling to me like a vow. I'll be yours when tonight is a memory. I'll be yours and you'll always be mine. Hand in hand as we stand near the old campus moon, make believe that tomorrow is here. Picture me, close to you in a dream house for two, where the ivy grows greener each year. Ivy rose, I'm in love with you. Cling to me.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Village Pioneer Bob Hill.
Yes, and more vines, but this time those that you can eat.
Well, right near and dear to your stomach.
Indeed. Actually, I just I have my squash in. I've got three different varieties, some of which are also heirloom varieties that you could get from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. That's what we're going to delve into now. If you've ever gotten the catalog of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds.
I don't think I have.
It is the most delightful thing, and I don't know, these people, I have got to get there. It just looks so super cool, and it reminds me of like what you would do if you were into like vegetables.
That's kind of scary.
Because it's got all this stuff to it that's magically delightful.
Ah.
How about that?
I'll accept that.
Okay. Yeah. So, joining us now is the guy behind all the magically delightful. Jer Gettle in Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds in Mansfield, Missouri. They've basically set out to preserve our pioneer and gardening heritage in more ways than one. Baker Creek carries over 1,200 different varieties of heirloom seed. And then there's another location, the Pioneer Village, which is called Bakersville. It's like one of the oldest homesteads in the country, kind of close to where they wrote the Little House on the Prairie stuff.
Oh, yeah, we've been there.
But Bakersville, there, the Pioneer Village preserves gardening history, techniques, crafts, and music. So among the heirloom offerings that they have up there, there are about 24 different varieties of summer squash. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Among some other things. But the squash come from around the world, have, you know, cultural influences clearly. And that's what has brought us to Jer Gettle. He knows the history of it all. Jer, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, it's good to be here. I sure appreciate you having me on.
Sure. Listen, tell us about Baker Creek and the Pioneer Village, Bakersville. Because basically, I can't wait to visit you all. I don't know when I'll have a chance, but how on earth did you achieve all that and get involved in all of that sort of comprehensive approach to old-time stuff?
Well, it basically all started kind of as a hobby. I'd always been interested in gardening and collecting. Basically, gardening and collecting are always my interests. And when I was small, I collected stamps and seeds and coins. And I was also really big into gardening. My parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were all farmers and gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of came naturally.
Are you from the area?
Originally, I was born in Napa, Idaho, and was raised out west till I was about 12, and then I've been here for the last 15, 16 years.
Okay. How old's the company and the village?
The seed company I started when I was 17, and that was back in 1998.
Because I thought you looked pretty darn young, so you started young.
Yeah, it was basically just a hobby. I was into collecting seed and trading seed, and it was basically, the first year I just printed it, it was a price list. The next year, it was right before Y2K, so it was a time when a lot of people were starting to get interested, you know,
right.
In heirlooms.
Sure.
Well, so you're not 30 yet.
No, not quite.
That's disgusting.
Wow. Even more impressive.
Yeah.
So what's the affiliation with Bakersville and the Pioneer Village? How'd you get involved in that?
As far as the village that we're working on now, which is just kind of still in the beginning phases where we got several buildings up, but it kind of started through our festivals. We have the festivals monthly,
mm-hmm.
and at first we started out with one summer show, and it went pretty good, and over the last 8 years we've been having festivals. They've been growing, so this last year we decided to branch out and go monthly, and so we've been having about 12 months of monthly festivals, and they've been growing,
mm-hmm.
and about the time we started the monthly festivals, we thought, we might as well put in something, you know, people can see anytime they come, and also something that will be more here when we have festivals. And we needed more buildings for music, and we needed more, just more attractions, we thought.
Mm-hmm.
We've put in some different old-time livestock exhibits, more gardens, and just different little things of interest, you know, local interest, and show people how people used to garden or the types of music that were used to be, you know, common in the area,
mm-hmm.
crafts, different arts, and food production methods, and basically we're trying to focus on everything that might have been, you know, done in the first half of the last century. Mm-hmm.
So if all hell breaks loose, we can come to Bakersville and you can take care of us, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what we're working on, trying to get it so, you know, we can educate people. A lot of people come and they've never seen, you know, they've hardly ever seen a rooster, let alone, you know, a lot of the different types of birds we have, or, you know, kids from out of town, you know, are just amazed to, mm-hmm. you know, see what different things look like and how food, you know, how food is made.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, the seed collecting part, how did you begin collecting seeds and where do you find them?
Well, in 1996, the spring of 1996, before that I was just getting them out of seed catalogs and like that mostly. But in the spring of 1996, I joined Seed Savers Exchange.
Right.
And started trading seeds with their members and several other gardening clubs. The internet was coming up, you know, big about that time. And people, you know, were doing more and more trading online. I just started, you know, anybody that I knew that might have seeds, I'd contact neighbors and whatnot, but mostly through like Seed Savers and online trading and stuff for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a few years, I started taking trips to different countries collecting seeds, like Thailand and Southeast Asia and
wow.
Mexico. And people, once they started getting the catalog, people almost from the very start, they started sending us packages of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this, my great grandma grew these, and these were passed down through Indian tribe and or whatever. You know, there's all kinds of stories on the different seeds that people send us.
Uh-huh. So is that part of the appeal for you? I mean, just the cultural history that some of these heirloom seeds represent.
It's a lot more interesting getting a seed that has, you know, a history than just getting one that has a name like Big White Bean. We get a lot like that that people want us to identify or whatever,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's not near as fun as when they actually have, you know, the history.
A story, too.
Well, how do you preserve and protect those old seeds?
Basically, what we try to do is get the seed grown out as soon as we can and get it in our catalog and get as many people growing it as we can. So get it back into circulation again.
How do you avoid the cross-fertilization problems?
We have to have a lot of different growers. Right now we have 50-some different growers that grow seed for us.
Oh, so scattered around the country there.
Yeah, we have growers throughout the Midwest and South and all through the United States.
Mm-hmm. We sought you out today specifically to talk about summer squash.
Sure.
Historically, how has summer squash been used around the world? You've talked about, you know, the travels to different countries. And that was the thing that, I mean, that's one of the markers for me when I'm, you know, shopping for seed for squash. I want to know where it came from, because then that sort of suggests how I should prepare it in the kitchen. Do you know
sure,
what I mean? In terms
yeah.
of cooking styles. So, you know, when you look at summer squash, how is it represented across the world?
Pretty much everywhere I've went so far, you know, especially in Latin America, summer squash is really big. And when you buy summer squash down there, like even at the grocery store, a lot of times it tastes so much better than what we get here.
Mm-hmm.
Our squash is generally kind of bland and just kind of somewhat flavorless. But like down in Guatemala, when I was down there a couple of years ago, the squash varieties they have there that they use for summer squash are just so much better tasting.
And, I mean, is that part of the reason our standards are so bland? I mean, just due to hybridization?
Hybridization and everything being uniform. So
mm-hmm.
basically you get one type that becomes common, and it has to be a good shipping type since, you know, the big companies only want stuff that ships well.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times shipping and flavor, you know, don't go together. The shipping alone, you know, destroys the flavor, and usually they start out with a variety that's pretty bland.
Mm-hmm.
So, how does shipping destroy the flavor? I'm sorry.
Basically, you know, the longer something's in storage, it depends on the crop. Squash ain't so much picking it green, because summer squash is just a green vegetable. It's one that's not ripe. But the longer something's in storage and refrigeration and in and out, the less, you know, the longer it's in storage, the less flavor it's going to have.
Mm-hmm. And basically, it's enzyme activity. It's like the enzymes that work to help ripen stuff continue
yeah.
to work and kind of break down after you've picked it. So the longer the enzymes have a chance to work at it, the less
taste. Yeah, the fresher a vegetable is, you know, the more wilted a vegetable. A lot of times you'll go into the Walmart or wherever to buy a zucchini, and it'll be, you know, a couple weeks old.
Mm-hmm.
And it just ain't going to taste as good as one that was picked, you know, that morning.
It's true.
And it just ain't possible because of the storage time. When they start wilting a little bit, and, you know, they don't look fresh and plump like a fresh picked zucchini is going to look.
Mm-hmm.
It's a better baseball bat, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. So, Jerry, let's talk about some of the different varieties that you all offer. You've got about 24 varieties, some of which I've grown, in fact. But, you know, what is cool, just talking about this whole sort of international flair, there's some that the English favor. There's French, there's Italian, there's Ukrainian, there's Texaco and Mexican favorites.
Yeah.
You know, so kind of highlight those affiliations as well as we go through the list of some of your favorite squash.
Yeah, some of my favorite squash anyway tend to be the scallop type squash. They're the squash I remember growing in my garden when I was 3 and 4 years old.
Mm-hmm. Are those the patty pan?
Patty pan or okay. Scallop.
Okay.
Squashes are the little ones that are flat and they look like a flying saucer shape, basically, mm-hmm. with little ridges. And those tend to have excellent flavor. They stay tender. They're just great all around eating squash. They're originally grown by the Native Americans when the early explorers and settlers came here. They were a variety that was really, really popular in the early periods of this country. Mm-hmm. And really, really popular with the French and the English. They mm-hmm. were shipped back to England and France. And in France, they developed a lot of different colors. We got, I think, 5 different colors of scallop squash in our catalog. Mm-hmm. And they're all great, and they all have really interesting histories.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of harvest time, you know, for peak flavor, how do we treat the patty pan squash, the scallop?
Well, there's pretty much any stage, but for frying or, you know, just cooking small, generally about 2 to 4 inches is good.
Okay, so pretty small.
But also, they're really good if you just let them mature and then peel them mm-hmm. and take the seeds out and, you know, fry them or bake them.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerry, my palate's not real subtle. I've been accused of that, but I'm a functional eater. But can you actually taste the difference between a Ukrainian squash and a Mexican squash?
It depends. Sometimes they're very similar, and other times they're, you know, a whole difference in taste. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it depends on the flesh color. Some of the summer squash tend to have more of a yellowish flesh, and they tend to taste, in my opinion, taste better than the ones that are really pure white. They're sweeter and more flavorful.
So what about the green? Or is that all the green considered zucchini?
The green, there
I mean, that's
is a
summer
lot of green
squash
squashes,
too.
But as far as their flesh goes, the mm-hmm. ones that have the white flesh tend to be pretty you know, pale tasting in comparison to
the yellow.
Any squash that has a yellowish flesh. Okay. The scallops tend to have a yellowish flesh. Another good one is the Zucchino Rampicante. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's a Italian squash.
Mm-hmm. See, those are the ones I like the Portofino and the Romanesco ones.
Yeah, those are very good.
They're nutty.
Yeah, the Italians, you know, really, and French really select their squash for flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And local markets over, like, a lot, most of our varieties are, like we talked earlier, you know, shipping, mm-hmm. where theirs tend to be more local markets, and so the varieties are, you know, really selected for flavor. If it doesn't taste good, they ain't going to be growing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can flavor be massaged by cultural practices? More water, less water, sun, shade, whatever?
To a point, it can change a little, but overall, the biggest thing that I found is, you know, just plant varieties that taste great. The other thing that we get a lot of interest in is people that like the little lemon squash.
And what's the lemon squash?
It's a small, round squash that's shaped just like a lemon.
Huh.
And it's colored like a lemon. It's basically like a crookneck squash without the neck.
Okay.
And it's very disease resistant, very easy to grow, and productive. It ain't as great tasting as some, but it's a nice tasting squash. Most people that try it really think it's a great tasting squash because they're used to, you know, the commercial varieties.
Right. But it doesn't have a citrus taste. It just looks like a lemon.
No, it just has a regular, it basically
that
tastes like
nice.
A crookneck squash.
Okay.
How do you find time to eat 24 different kinds of squash?
Yeah, well, I don't think I've eaten them all over 1 year. It's just kind of normally, you know, 4 or 5 this year and
there you go.
6 or 8 this year.
And uh-huh.
Actually, this year, though, we are trialing, I believe, every summer squash and all the squash in the Pepo species, which is a lot of summer squash and
sure
some of the pumpkins and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. But all heirloom varieties.
All heirloom varieties. And I think we got probably about 40 different varieties we're trying of that species this year.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if I'm going to get them all tried or not.
Yeah. You need to start working on having a big family.
Well, are the heirlooms still coming in from strange places and wonderful names and seeds and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Every year we get stuff that's, you know, really fascinating. We got more stuff each year that we can get people to grow or that we can grow for seed. It's just incredible amount of seed out there still that people are preserving. You know, we'll have people email us from Guatemala with a unique squash, or with the internet, people find out about us from a lot of different countries. We have people from New Zealand and Russia. And, oh, just every week we probably get in anywhere from 2 or 3 to 10 seed samples.
Wow.
From different people that are, you know, find out about us one way or another.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let's talk growing tips for the best squash possible.
Okay, sure.
Your time's up.
Yeah, basically what we do here is we just plant in bottom land, and they like a good, rich, you know, soil.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have, you know, good soil, you should probably put on some chicken manure or cow manure or something, you know, alfalfa, something to get the soil on a little richer. And we use soaker hoses and put straw over the soaker hoses underneath the plants.
Mm-hmm.
To keep the weeds down, and that pretty last year we pretty much had 100% of the weeds blocked. We really didn't do any weeding at all by just putting a thick layer of straw down.
Excellent.
And they just go great in that.
Mm-hmm.
Just turn the soaker hoses on about once a week and get the soil good and moist. The biggest thing is just keeping the squash bugs from killing them.
I was going to say, do you struggle with pest problems? And what do you do?
What we've done this last year is there's a spray out. It's a natural garden spray, and you can get it in like a quart bottle. Walmart carries it. They only have like one brand, so it's easy to find. It's Green Light, and it's like natural garden spray. And I can't remember the active ingredient in it offhand.
It's probably neem or something.
Yeah, it's called natural garden spray. It wasn't neem, but anyway, if you just look for natural garden spray under the Green Light brand, you can at least figure out what it is.
What the active ingredient is.
What the active ingredient is, if you want to buy just the active ingredient someplace else. But you can get it at Walmart, and I'm sure Lowe's, and anybody that carries the Green Light brand. And a quart of that will go quite a ways.
So
it'll make like around 8 gallons of spray.
So that helped ward off any major squash bug infestations?
Yeah. It doesn't, you know, the main thing that we found is if you have a terrible problem with them, it's plant varieties that have somewhat of a resistance to squash bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's number one. And then number two is, you know, spraying them with something that helps control them a little, at least.
Yeah, I always get them by the, you know, high summer, no matter what I do, it seems.
Well, Jerry, speaking of summer, Janine's leaning toward the door to get out to Missouri here pretty quick. What's going on this summer that people can come see?
Oh, at our place here, there's we have a festival going the first Sunday of every month, and then August we have the two-day festival with a lot of different gardening speakers.
August may be the time.
Produce exhibits, produce contests, crafters and whatnot. But every month we'll have produce here and vendors and music, and August will just be a two-day event that will be a little larger. People can stop by, you know, anytime they're in the Ozarks. We're kind of on the way from Branson coming from the east. We're only an hour and a half from Branson, and we're right on Highway 60, so anybody coming from the east, most of them take Highway 60 to get to Branson, so we're just off of that highway.
Cool. Pretty convenient, huh? Thank you, Jerry. We so appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll sure appreciate it, and have a great day.
You too. Jerry Gettle owns Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, where the goal is to enjoy and preserve fabulous vegetables from the past. Baker Creek carries over 1,200 different varieties of heirloom seed. Jerry spoke to us from Baker Creek in Mansfield, Missouri. And of course, if you'd like more information on Baker Creek and Bakersville, please see our website at WFPL.org. You don't want to miss this.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and a new Latin word from Miss Wishy. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we're being dogged with more questions, Ms. Wishy.
We are being dogged with more questions. This one's from Don. He's got a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old dogwood. They seem to be healthy, but wondered if he should fertilize them. Also, when he should trim some of the lower limbs and what kind of fertilizer he should use. And he also has some azaleas he'd like to fertilize, so he's wondering when the best time is and the best type to use.
Well, the dogwoods, I would just sort of enjoy them.
Yeah, I mean,
at that size and that age, I wouldn't prune them at all because you're not sure where they're going to go, and they shouldn't need a lot of fertilizer.
You got to ask the question, like, Are they not very vigorous for
some reason? They said they're healthy, yeah.
I think people think that they have to fertilize more than they really do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Water is probably key to young dogwoods establishing more than anything else and not any fertilizer.
In fact, I've got 8 acres of plants I never fertilize.
I don't either.
I have good soil, and I water them when I need it, but I never fertilize.
Yeah. Except, if something looks like it lacks vigor for some hardcore reason, yes. But in a typical situation, you really don't have to, I don't think.
They overdo it. Yeah. And azaleas, I think the best time is probably just about when they're getting ready to bloom in the spring. Mm-hmm. Is that your feeling on that?
Yeah. And again, if they look good, then you don't. But azaleas like a acid soil. So sometimes using something formulated for acid-loving plants can help, you know, kind of keep the pH in the right place, Bob, don't you think? So if you want to do your azaleas, but I wouldn't worry about your dogwoods right now.
Yeah, and I looked this up online. The Azalea Association of America, or Society of America, says don't fertilize at all. If you have good organic, it's the ideal situation.
Yeah,
good organic
compost.
Soil, mulch with pine straw. Mm-hmm. But they said more azaleas are killed with kindness than neglect.
Huh, so there.
Hold that thought.
So it's easier than you think.
Okay. A question from Miss Wishy, right to your garden, from Kent, for Miss Wishy. With the rising cost of fresh produce, my wife and I have decided to plant a garden this year. Yes.
Yes.
We love asparagus. I did research to find how to plant it, and it sounds like I need crowns. Mm-hmm. Where's a good place to purchase crowns in the Louisville area?
Buttons usually has crowns. Mm-hmm. Just check with your, basically, you kind of missed your window of opportunity because you plant in early spring, but you have a second window in fall. You can also plant in fall. Ideally, it's best to plant them in the spring of the year, however. So like late summer, if you can get your hands on some crowns, I would do that. You can order them out of many of the catalogs, like seed catalogs. They send you crowns. They don't send you seeds. But I know that Buttons has them, and I'm sure that other, you know, smaller local nurseries would probably have some crowns too. So you might just have to do a little investigating. The next time you're in your neighborhood garden center, ask them if they'll have any, you know, in the fall or if they can get them for you. If not, you can order them out of a catalog.
Okay. You have a royal question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246. We're still waiting for our first letter of 2008 as far as I'm concerned.
We haven't gotten many lately.
Send your letter to 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, and we'll read it with love and care.
We will indeed.
Well, Miss Wishy, you've got the Noah's Ark of Latin words today.
I brought this to the table today.
I was surprised.
In honor of all those people that have birthdays right now.
Geminis?
From late May through June. My mother is a Gemini, and so is my husband.
I never put the two and two together.
Yes, and it makes perfect sense. This is for all the Geminis out there with their dual personalities.
and you
Gemini
get equal time
are the,
next
exactly.
Week.
When I first started dating them, I'm like, "You're a Gemini? Oh no." Geminatus, Geminatum, Geminata means paired.
I never would have thought that. Yeah, twins. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm a Scorpio. Go figure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it shows, doesn't
it? I'm an Aries.
Okay.
All right. For example, Paspalidium, Geminatum, the Egyptian Panicum.
Yeah.
Which is like a switchgrass.
Absolutely.
So likely the little seed things at the top are paired, right?
You got it.
Agrostis, another grass. Agrostis, Geminatum,
Twin bent grass.
Twin bent grass. The name says it all.
Twin.
Quercus geminata.
The sand live oak.
You know, those great oak trees that have all the stuff hanging from them, that moss.
Yeah.
And last but not least, rhizocarpon geminatum.
The map lichen.
Map lichen. So something about the plant's going to be paired, and typically in these examples, it has everything to do, I think, with the seed head part of the plant. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
So the little seed's going to come in a two little pair thingy-ma-bob. How's that?
Not just twins, but paired.
But paired. Or twins. We could call them could call them twins as well. But that's for all you Geminis out there. If you see a plant that has Geminatus, Geminatum, or Geminata, you know that there's a twin about them or a pair about them as well.
I hear you.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week, we'll be on the road visiting some folks' gardens.
Homegrown is produced by one-of-a-kind Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.